I'm delighted this afternoon to be able to welcome Mona Hooker to Greenbelt and to introduce her to you. Mona Hooker is the Lady Margaret's Professor Emerita of Divinity at the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of Robinson College. She is one of the theologians who revised the NEB to produce the Revised English Bible, and she's the author of a recent book on Paul entitled A Short Introduction to Paul, which is published by One World and which is available in the Jesus Christ Superstore. And this afternoon she's going to share with us the first in a series of two talks on Paul over the course of the weekend, which I'm sure are set to challenge and refresh our views. Mona, thank you.
Thank you very much, and hello everybody. This is my first experience of Greenbelt. It's also the first time I found myself speaking on a race course. I've tried a football stadium, but there's always something new. Well, the title I've been given for this afternoon is Paul, Advocate of Freedom. Ask many people what they think about Paul, what kind of image they have of him, and you may very well get the answer that, he was a rather disagreeable little man with a great bee in his bonnet about something called justification by faith, who was forever laying down the law. He was always telling people what to do and what to believe, which is very odd indeed, because Paul was forever insisting that people are not under law, and he was a great advocate of freedom. I'm not sure whether he would have quite agreed with Augustine saying that Christianity was really a question of love God and do what you like. Love God, yes, maybe he would have wanted to rephrase that, do what you like, but he would have gone a certain way with Augustine. So why do people get him so badly wrong? Well, of course, first of all, he was a theologian. And theologians, as we all know, are not the easiest people to read and understand. They tend to go in for obscure arguments and to use lots of abstract nouns. And Paul has his share. Justification, for example, redemption, sanctification. What do the long words actually mean? But among all this theology, he sometimes gets down to the nitty-gritty. As well as theology, we have what we call ethics, advice about behaviour. The do's and the don'ts, those are much easier to grasp, and so we cotton on to those much easier, much more easily. Pay your taxes, for example, he says. Keep sober. Avoid immorality. That comes several times in Paul's letters. And don't sponge on others. We may very well lose our way in Paul's long theological arguments. And sometimes he tends to lose the way himself. He breaks off in the middle of a sentence and forgets where he's going. Well, we all do it. And Paul, of course, was speaking and someone else was writing it down. And I'm sorry for the poor chap who was trying to keep up with Paul as he dictated his theology. And the result is that it's quite often difficult to grasp what he's saying, and so we tend to remember the clear bits. Paul certainly had very clear ideas about how a Christian should behave, and how even more strong ideas about how a Christian should not behave. Paradoxically, then, we remember his do's and his don'ts. And we remember the fact that for Paul was forever insisting on one particular theological point, And that was the point. Don't put yourself under law. Don't. Ah, he's laying down the law at the very moment when he's saying, don't put yourself under law. Paradoxically, we think of him as a legalist, as a lawgiver. The other reason why we tend to think of Paul as obscure, but nevertheless making particular points, being something of a lawgiver, is that Paul was writing in a very different context from our own. He lived in a very different world. Paul had no idea that we would be reading what he had said 2,000 years later. If he'd had any idea of that, I'm sure he would have made himself a great deal clearer. And the images that Paul used were naturally the images of the first century. He's a great guy for what we'd call sermon illustrations. They don't always fit very well, but he goes in for them. And the world he lived in was the first century world. It was very different from our own. And the situation he was dealing with was very different from ours. The social structures were those of the first century. Very different world from our own. Sometimes I hear clips from old broadcasts on the radio. They seem to come from a different world. Snippets, for example, of people talking before the last war, back in the 30s, or snippets of broadcasts from the Second World War. It's a different world. They even speak differently. Their accents are different. They use BBC English. Their assumptions were different. They speak a foreign language. And Paul certainly speaks a foreign language. But one thing is clear. One of Paul's buzzwords was the word freedom. And it's a buzzword today. Here we are at Greenbelt in 2004, and the theme is freedom. Freedom, what do we think of? We think of freedom from poverty, freedom from hunger, freedom from appalling conditions of work. What would a first century audience have thought of when Paul talked about freedom? Well, it would have been a very meaningful term to one very large group of people in his day. And that was the group of slaves. The Roman Empire depended on slaves. Slave labour was cheap. Anyone who was anyone owned slaves, owned large numbers of slaves. You didn't have labour-saving gadgets around the house. You didn't need them. You had slaves to do all the manual labour. But you also had slaves to do what today we would regard as middle-class jobs. It wasn't just physical labour. The whole of society depended on this very large group of slaves. Now, some of them were well-treated. Others were not, and led a very hard life. One thing was common to them all, however. They had no status in their own rights. They were non-persons. They were owned by someone else, and their owners could do what they liked with them. They could even put them to death if they felt that they were guilty of some demeanour, though that's not a very good idea. I mean, if you put your own slave to death, you lose his services, so it's better to keep him alive and flog him. But that's what it was like to be a slave in the ancient world, or that's what it was like for many people. Now, of course, you could change your status. It was possible in the Roman world to win your freedom. If you pleased your master, for example, he might emancipate you. He might set you free as a reward for your faithful service. Or you might save up money. You might get tips, for example, and you might save them up, and eventually you would be able to buy your own freedom. Now, to buy your own freedom, you went through a kind of legal fiction. It was necessary to take the money along to a temple and deposit the money into the account of the god who was worshipped in that temple. And then by legal fiction, you were bought from your owner by the god who set you free. And that was known as being redeemed. The only equivalent we have today for that, I suppose, is going to a pawn shop, if you've had to pawn all your goods, and you are able to redeem your goods. Redemption. That's what the word redemption means. Being set free. Redeeming something. Among the Jewish people, slavery was rare. And there was a 6-year rule. You couldn't keep a slave for more than 6 years, and at the end of 6 years, you had to set them free. Kind of sabbatical for slaves. And the reason was that slavery was really frowned on. You shouldn't be a slave of a fellow Jew. Why not? Because you were all the slaves of God himself. God himself had redeemed his people by bringing them out of slavery in Egypt. He had, as it were, bought them. He had redeemed them from slavery and set them free. So they were now, as it were, slaves of God. But the notion of being slaves jars on us. We don't like to think of ourselves as being slaves, but in the ancient world, to be the slave of God, Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, that was the God of Israel, that was an honour, because you belonged to him. And in the ancient world, there was a slave didn't have any status in his or her own right. They took on the status of their owner. If you belonged to a high-up member of the Senate in Rome, then you had real status. And if you belong to the God of Israel, well, what greater status than that could there be? Israel were God's people. So with that kind of background, think what kind of impact Paul's message would have had in the ancient world. It's no wonder that it went down a bomb among certain classes. Writing to the Corinthians, he comments that not many of you were high-born, not many were rich. Of course not, because the people who flocked to hear Paul and to respond to his message tended to be the people who had nothing, and many of them would have been slaves, people without status, suddenly being given significance in the eyes of God. People who had no status in the world were God's slaves, Christ's slaves, a title of great honour, and they were all equal in God's sight. Rich and poor, slave and free, all were equal in Christ. Not only that, but they were equal in their sharing in the inheritance that God offered to his people, to his children. People who hadn't been people because they had been nobodies suddenly were people. Okay, you say, but hang on, what actual difference did it make to these chaps? Had their situation actually changed? Were they any better off? Did their masters emancipate them? Did they regard them as their equals? Of course they didn't. So Did they no longer have to obey their masters? There would have been a riot if they had refused. But the point was that they felt that they had another master, Christ, that they belonged to him, and that in God's eyes they shared Christ's status. He was God's son, now they were God's children. So is this just otherworldly, you would say? Is it just pie in the sky, something you're going to get when you die? No, because in Paul's view, it transformed life here and now. They were free in spirit. They might not be free in everyday life, but they were free in the eyes of God. Now, of course, in the 21st century, we tend to think, well, why didn't Paul do something about this situation of slavery? Why didn't he campaign to change things? Why didn't he organise a petition and get everyone to lobby the government for emancipation? And the answer to that, of course, is firstly that it would have been impossible. Christians in the first century had no political power. They couldn't pull strings. No one would have listened to them. They would have been laughed to scorn. And indeed, Paul was laughed to scorn on many occasions. Changing things takes time. Some campaigns take years. Some take centuries. Often you feel you're banging your head against a brick wall in signing these postcards and posting them off. Trade justice, we all demand it. And yet we all know we live in a world which depends on trade injustice. Our market forces enslave millions. They may not enslave them literally, but they certainly enslave them in poverty. Structures in society take years to change. And Paul was trapped in his first century world. He couldn't change it. He couldn't opt out of it any more than we can opt out of our world, however much we may campaign for changes. But I think if you had asked Paul why he wasn't campaigning for emancipation, he would have said that he'd got a more fundamental message to proclaim, and that was the gospel about Jesus Christ, a gospel about more fundamental freedoms. And of course, over the course of centuries, it was that gospel that did great things in bringing about literal emancipation for slaves. So what kind of freedom was he talking about? Well, first of all, most of Paul's converts, most of the people who heard him preach were Gentiles. They were living in a pagan world and they worshipped pagan gods, great variety of gods. But one thing these gods had in common, they were a fickle lot. And you needed the gods on your side. We're hearing a great deal just at the moment about the various myths of Greece and Rome. Go to the cinema and you may see Troy. I haven't been to see it, but I'm sure the Greek myths are embedded in that story. You could hardly tell it without. The Odyssey is being broadcast by the BBC this weekend. It is a very strange world. A world where the gods are very powerful. And those gods were very real to the first century men and women. And the gods were dangerous. They were powerful, but they were very fickle. You had to be careful with them. You had to make sure that they were on your side. Freedom then from fear of the gods. What were these gods? Nothing. There was one God, and he was supreme. You don't have to worry about that lot. And similarly, the Gentile worlds were under the power of astral forces. I don't know how seriously people take their horoscopes. They're printed every day, apparently, in the newspapers. You can ring a number and find out what your horoscope is. Do people really live by them? Well, they certainly did in the first century. You couldn't do anything significant without getting your horoscope. Your life was governed by these forces, and some of them were pretty alien forces. They had terrifying power. You're free from them, says Paul. Terrific message. You're no longer their slaves. You have been redeemed. You have been bought by God, and you've been given a new status, status as God's slaves, God's children. God is far more powerful than all these gods and all these astrological powers. So relax. Writing to the Thessalonians, he reminds them that they turned from idols to serve a living and true God. There's that verb, to serve. We haven't got a verb that gets across the slave element in it, but it's the service given by a slave to his master. You turn to serve the true and living God. You've changed your owner. And the second thing from which Paul would have said they would set free was sin. Paul was very hot on sin, which was hardly surprising because there was plenty of it in the ancient world. And the universal experience of Jews and Gentiles was indulgence in sin. We tend to think of sins in the plural. We talk about the seven deadly sins, though I'm not going to give a prize to anyone who can remember them all. Though I doubt if many people can, but we all know there were seven of them. But for Paul, sin had a capital S, as it were. It was an alien power which has us in its grasp. This alien power has enslaved us. It compels us to obey it. And again, Paul uses the image of changing masters. You're no longer the slaves of sin, you're the slaves of Christ. You're no longer the slaves of sin, you're the slaves of righteousness. Paradoxical, but you can't put it any better way. Christians are slaves of Christ because he is their new owner. You don't belong to yourselves, he writes to the Corinthians. You've been bought with a price. And so you are to present yourselves to God, not to sin, because he's your master and you're serving him. Sin is no longer in a position of power over you. You need obey sin no longer. And thirdly and finally, Paul talks about freedom from law. The Gentiles were under the astral powers. The Jews were under law. Preferable to being under the astral powers, certainly. But the problem with law is that it becomes a matter of obligation. Don't exceed the speed limit, otherwise you'll get some points on your license. Don't park on the double yellow lines, otherwise you'll get towed away. It threatens us. But things to do with one's relationship with God shouldn't be under a threat. One's relationship with God is supposed to be a relationship of love. Love God, love him. If you tell a couple who are about to marry that they should draw up a legal contract and define their relationship by rules, they are heading for disaster. If you have a contract about how many times a week you're going to do the washing up, and if you don't do it, you're going to get divorced, heaven help you. Relationship with God is a relationship of love. It shouldn't be under constraint. God is your master. He's bought you, but it's a matter of sheer grace, says Paul. He wanted you. He loved you. He gave himself for you. So respond to him, not out of fear, but out of love. And instead of living according to law, you must live according to the Spirit, God's Spirit. And where the Spirit is, there is freedom. Another of Paul's images is about being children and adults. Being under law is like being a child. You're under discipline. You are told, do this, don't do that. And in Paul's world, in the first century, when you were told to do this and not to do that as a child, you obeyed. It may not happen today, but it did then. You were under law. But now you've come of age, says Paul, and you are free to enjoy the inheritance of children because you are God's children. Okay, freedom from law, freedom from sin, freedom from the pagan deities and astral powers. How would Paul's audience have reacted? Their initial reaction would probably have been to say, wow. Wow, we're free to do what we like. Love God and do what you like. You've been set free. But hang on a minute. Loving God means taking note of what sort of God this is. And the God Paul was talking about was a very holy and righteous God. The Corinthians were famous for their immorality and their indulgence. Paul had a great deal of problems with the Corinthians. And they, hearing Paul's message, said, we've been set free, good, we can eat what we like, we can do what we like, we can behave as we like. And Paul put his foot in and said, no. You must ask the question, is what you're doing compatible with loving a holy and righteous God? Do what you like, yes, but what you like should be what God likes. And you have to remember what God is like. And then you'll get it right. So, love God. But there's another bit of this commandment, which is always connected with it in the New Testament. Love God and love your neighbour. And freedom, for Paul, turns out to be about getting on with your neighbour. He talks about life in the Spirit, life which is freedom. And it means patience, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, but above all, love. All qualities which relate you to your next door neighbour. Be patient, be kind, be faithful, be gentle, be loving. And out of the window go things like quarrels, bad temper, envy, selfishness, and disputes. In other words, freedom, yes, but personal freedom mustn't get out of hand. Look a little closer at what Paul says, and you'll find that he tells his convert that they should be serving one another. There's that verb again. Doing the work of a slave for one another. Serve one another. That's what loving them means. That's what loving your neighbour involves. Paul's language is paradoxical, and that may be why we get him wrong. He talks about freedom, yes. You're set free, but you're set free to serve God and to serve other people. You're no longer slaves, you're free. Why? Because you're slaves of Christ. It's clear that even at the time when Paul was writing, people found what he was saying rather difficult. And a lot of the people to whom Paul wrote got him wrong. Those Corinthians, for example, they tended to get him wrong. Some of them got swept away by the talk of freedom. They went for personal liberty. Freedom to be yourself, great. And they identified that with indulgence. Don't worry about other people, just enjoy yourself. Clearly they got Paul completely wrong. It had turned into loving yourself instead of loving God and your neighbour. And seeing that kind of reaction to Paul, other people reacted in a very different way and said, clearly we need rules, we need laws, we need a code of do's and don'ts. And so they started creating them. And the problem with religion tends to be that we find it very difficult just to live by the code of loving God and loving neighbour. We always want to ask the question which was asked of Jesus, but please give me a definition of my neighbour, or give me a definition of love. And so if you look down the course of church history, you will see how people have pored over Paul and turned him into a lawgiver. Even in Paul's own day, he tended to be treated in the same way. People tended to say, oh, look, Paul says this, we must do it literally. Instead of thinking things out for themselves, instead of thinking, what does love mean in my situation? Fortunately, Paul didn't actually lay down many rules. Occasionally he does, but if you actually hunt through his letters, you'll see there aren't all that many do's and don'ts. Most of them, as I say, were when he was dealing with those troublesome Corinthians. There was, for example, that problem about what men and women should wear in church. And Paul is very clear about the answer to that one. But that's a problem that I'm going to come back to tomorrow. Over to you. Questions, reactions, objections.
Okay, I've got a microphone here that I can bring as far as the white rails. So if you have a question and you're on the steps, you'll need to come forward. If you just put your hands up, I'll try and take people, a variety of people in a variety of places in the venue. Anybody like to follow that with a question or a comment? Okay.
I wanted to ask how risky it was for a slave to say, I'm now the slave of Christ, in terms of their daily living and the reaction of their master or mistress if he or she was not also a Christian?
That's a very difficult question because I don't actually have any evidence on which to answer it. And so I'm simply guessing. I think if a slave were a Bolshe and sort of said, oh, I'm a slave of Christ, I don't have to obey you, he would have got a very bad reaction. But clearly that's not what is involved. As long as being a slave of Christ didn't affect his obedience to his master, I imagine that the owner probably would take no notice and say it's irrelevant as long as it didn't interrupt his duties. I mean, in time, the fact that Christians were refusing to acknowledge the gods who were worshipped by their master, that would cause problems. And it might well lead to a rift. So it probably depends very much on the reaction of the actual owner of the slave. If the owner were a Christian, of course, it's a different matter altogether. But a Christian slave working for a pagan master, well, it might not lead to any trouble, but I think in time, if it involved the slave in refusing to take part in pagan worship, for example, that would lead to trouble.
On across here.
This is an entirely spontaneous thought that just popped into my head while you were speaking, so excuse me if it's sort of a bit unformed at the moment. It struck me what you were saying, that Paul doesn't lay down many rules. Is it perhaps that the fact that at the moment Paul is very much misunderstood is because he does seem to have laid down rules in two very specific areas, or we believe he some people believe he does, so basically the relationship of women and men and on issues of sexuality, and that suddenly because those issues are now the forefront issues of possibly Western society, that he has become either this horrible, he has become this horrible bogeyman or bogeyperson in fact, in certain areas. I remember reading in Stephen Fry's autobiography where he's remembering a Methodist minister who influenced him in his early years, that he sort of takes a sort of parenthetical few sentences just to say how dreadful and horrible he thinks Paul is. This is Stephen Fry speaking now about on St. Paul, and obviously the issue of homosexuality is very close to Stephen Fry's heart. Is it the fact that on those two particular issues we're now very concerned about those things, and Paul seems to be very vehement on both?
Yeah, thank you. I think you may be putting your finger on something rather important, that those issues have come to the forefront, and this is why people take particular exception to Paul now. The question of women, well, as I say, I am coming back to that tomorrow, but the problem in relation to both these issues is that Paul was very much a man of his own culture, a man of the first century. Now, what he said about women, in fact, is totally misunderstood. He, in fact, as I shall argue tomorrow, should be understood far more as a champion of women's rights than the opposite. Nevertheless, he was working within the constraints of first century society, where it was assumed that men had certain rights and women rather like slaves, didn't. I mean, women were chattels of their husbands in the ancient Jewish world, for example. And Paul inherits all the structures of society of his time, and he is thinking and working within them, and it's hardly fair to accept Paul to have 21st attitudes in the first century. The question of sexuality, again, Paul's attitudes are certainly shaped by his Jewish upbringing. He is, as I'm forever saying, Jewish to his fingertips. His ethics are basically Jewish. He has been formed by his Jewish upbringing. Therefore, he inherits all the Old Testament understanding about the evils of immorality, and homosexuality is one issue. And so he rather takes it for granted that the norm is good, and that the norm is set out in Genesis, a man and a woman together, and that any kind of fornication or any kind of sexual immorality or irregularity is contrary to God's will. That is part of his given And I think you can only make sense of Paul if you remember that that is the context and the understanding that he inherited. And we can't expect him suddenly to understand what 21st century people may now understand about the medical problems involved and so on. Is that an answer?
Good afternoon. I wonder whether you'd like to comment on the thought that maybe some of the so-called obscurity of Paul is as much to do with the fact that he's trying to translate Hebrew concepts into Greek, both Greek language and Greek ethics and philosophy.
Well, certainly I sometimes wonder how Paul's converts made sense of any of the arguments that he's using, because he does tend to use ideas which come from his own background. He tends to expound scripture, for example. Scripture is his given, it's where he starts from. And he obviously expects his converts to be familiar with scripture and to understand his rather strange way of expounding it. It wasn't strange if you were a Jewish rabbi in the first century, but his Greek converts, you can imagine them sitting puzzled, listening to one of his letters, saying, "What is this chap on about?" So I think, yes, he would. But he does tend to use these everyday images. I mean, like freedom, which would surely have meant a great deal in the ancient world. And they all knew about inheritance. They all knew that the firstborn son was the chap who got it all. And here is Paul saying everybody gets a share, not just the firstborn son. You're all equal in God's sight. So he does use everyday images which would have been meaningful, mixed in with some of these obscurities which would have made it difficult. But to understand quite a lot of his vocabulary, you do have to remember that he's probably thinking in very Jewish way. You can't really understand the New Testament without you understanding the Old Testament. People pick up the New Testament and think they can make sense of it. You've got to begin with the Old. It's the only way of understanding it. So much of the imagery, so many of the ideas, so many of the assumptions come out of the Old Testament. And Paul isn't just sort of doing a new thing in a new world. He is claiming that the God whom he's always worshipped, the God of Israel, has now spoken in a new and even clearer way in the person of his son. So you've got to really understand it in terms of what the Old Testament says.
Thank you very much for your talk, Mona. I wonder if, over here, I wonder if we today face a similar problem to Paul, though, in that people of his time and perhaps later felt that he was constantly laying down the law and was a legalist and had all sorts of strictures about moral behaviour, and yet he wanted to be a liberator and freeing people from various powers and forces. And we today, as Christians, are trying to show the Christian life as a liberating power to people and want them to live in the freedom of Christ. And yet people are constantly seeing it as a repressive force and a place where they will be restricted by rules and laws and so on. How do we get across freedom in Christ?
Yeah, that's a problem. Very difficult to get rid of your image, isn't it? And you can't really do it unless someone is prepared to listen and talk it through with you. I mean, what I find about Paul is that when he has any ethical problem, for example, he doesn't just lay down the law. He tends to go back to first principles. He tends to say, well, now look, what's the gospel about? The gospel is about God giving up his son for us. What does that tell me about my situation? How should I react? Well, it might be in terms of doing the same sort of thing, showing the same kind of love that Christ showed. Or it might mean something else. But he goes back to first principles, which is about love, and says, okay, how do I think about what love means in this situation? Now, the trouble is that all takes time, and you have to have a seminar about every ethical problem, and it's much quicker to come out with a short code and sort of 10 commandments about what you do and you don't do, and so you tend to be thought to be a legalist. And as I said, there is a great tendency in religion. If you look at religion over the centuries, we do like to be told what to do and what not to do. It's very odd. It's sort of something innate in human nature. I mean, we protest about it, and yet it's much easier if you're told, oh, don't walk on the grass, than if you've got to stop and think, well, now, is it all right for me to walk on the grass, and what are the guidelines which ought to be governing my behaviour? Look what the Roman Catholic Church did in the Middle Ages with Christianity. They tended to turn it into a code of law. Look what the Protestants did in the 19th century. It came to be a question of do's and don'ts. Look what happens in fundamentalist Islam today. So many people who have got Islam wrong think that it is telling them to do certain things. We tend to think of religion, instead of a question of being loving God and working out what it means for ourselves, in terms of do's and don'ts. So I think it's something to do with human nature, which is sort of a cusset, because it likes to be told what to do or not to do, if only in order to show that we don't like those rules. It's something to do with human nature, I think.
There's a theme in Pauline studies that would say that Paul was the founder of Christianity. Could you say something about the relation of Paul's writings to the Gospels? Is there a harmony there, is there discontinuity?
There is continuity, far more so than discontinuity. I wouldn't say that Paul was the founder of Christianity. I think that's a misinterpretation. As far as we can gather, Paul was teaching the same gospel that other people were teaching. There is a very close relationship between the message of Jesus and the message of Paul. The great difference is that if you read the Gospels and you say, what is the message of Jesus in Matthew and Mark and Luke, you will see that the message is about the kingdom of God, it's about loving God, it's about obedience to God. It's not about me, Jesus. Although all those Gospels end with the death and resurrection of Christ, and although the spotlight is on him from the very beginning, the message of Jesus himself comes across very clearly as about loving God and about what God is doing. Now, clearly God is acting in Jesus. But when we get to Paul, he is the first person who is writing, who is presenting us with the Christian gospel from this side of the death and resurrection of Christ. And now the focus has shifted, and it's very much on the person of Christ and what he has done in dying and rising. It's the same message. It's about the love of God. It's about responding to God. But we see in the death and resurrection of Christ a way of getting into that message, because for Paul that is the way which enables us. Christ is the one who really loves God, and by being his follower we share his love for God. So I think there is far more continuity. Of course there is a discontinuity between Jesus and Paul in the death and resurrection. Of course there's discontinuity because Jesus is pointing to God and Paul is pointing to Jesus. But we have to remember that in pointing to Jesus, he's talking about what God is doing through him.
Hi, Mona. Hi. Going back to this question of how you decide what your service means. Okay. You mentioned that Paul's main criteria was scripture. That was what he started from. And then he goes and forms Gentile churches. And I think he encounters situations which he hadn't previously thought of. I wonder if you think he begins to use other criteria. And I wonder in particular what weight you think he gives to experience, human experience, in deciding what we should do.
Human experience. Can you give me an example?
I suppose I was thinking of that passage in 1 Corinthians where Christians start to be married to non-Christians, as it were. He begins to say things like, if your non-Christian spouse wants to divorce you, it's okay, you know, and so on. Clearly, he's come up against some cases which he hadn't encountered before.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite clear that he's having to work things out, because every now and again he says, well, this is what I think, and I think I've got the mind of Christ, but I mean, it's almost as though he's saying, I'm doing my best to see this in the light of the gospel. Of course he's having new experiences and coming across situations which haven't arisen before. I mean, it's a problem that wouldn't have arisen in Judaism, because Jews married Jews, and it was you didn't marry outside, and if a woman married a Jewish man, she would become Jewish. So the problem hadn't arisen before. It's something he's having to think out for the first time. But again, I think he's seeing it in the light of the gospel, which is about, is God going to be glorified through this? Am I, in some sense, will this relationship lead to somebody being brought to Christ through it? Or will it cause dissension? Because dissension is not in accordance with the gospel. And if it's just going to lead to disputes, then it would be better for them to separate. So I think he's going back to the principle of, you know, what does the love of God tell me about this situation? But I mean, I think that's interesting, because so many of our problems are things that Paul would never have dreamt of, you know, genetic research and all that sort of area. And you turn in vain to Paul for an answer until you remember that he didn't tend to say, oh, you do this and that and the other in these particular situations. What he says is, what does the gospel tell me about how to react? And I think that's what Christians ought to be doing, going back and saying, well, the gospel's about God loving us and about giving his son. How do we love God? How do we love our neighbour in this situation? And sometimes it come up with conflicting answers, because you might be loving your neighbour in one way, you might be loving them in another, and that might be conflict. But that's where you've got to think it out.
Just one last question then.
What do you make of some of Tom Wright's work and just the kind of new perspective in general?
Well, Tom is actually building on the work of others in the New Perspective. The New Perspective isn't quite as old as new as all that. I mean, scholars have been saying this kind of thing for more years than you might imagine. Much of what Tom says, I agree with. Indeed, I was hearing him lecture the other day, and he said to me, well, I heard you say all that in Oxford years ago. So, I mean, we do say very similar things. If you mean the sort of basic, I mean, Tom's got so many different things. I'm not sure which in particular you're talking about. I mean, are you saying, I mean, the emphasis on the fact that we've got to see Paul as very much in the Jewish context?
I think I was particularly thinking the whole thing of the way he talks. Well, he and Sanders talk about the way that Luther interpreted Paul wrongly.
Well, Luther did in many ways. He misunderstood Paul. We all misunderstood Paul because we all read him through our own spectacles. It was a valid interpretation for his own day. I mean, if you say that Luther got it wrong, then you are really sort of denying that Christians should be sort of saying, what does the Bible have to say to me in my situation? And I'm quite sure that Luther was right to say that Paul would have insisted that being in a right relationship with God was a matter of grace and not a matter of merit. The problem comes when then you read that back into Paul's own situation and say that Paul was against his fellow Jews and he was writing off the whole of Judaism as a legalistic religion. Paul was not doing that. I mean, he had been brought up a Jew. He had striven to love God. Judaism was a religion of grace. Christianity is an offshoot of Judaism in that sense. So that Luther got some things right, he got some things wrong. What we have to do is to interpret Paul for our own day and say, well, if Paul was right in saying what he did, how does that affect us today? But understanding Paul in his own time is always a problematic thing, which is why scholars are all forever arguing about it. Luther may not have got him right. Tom Wright may not have got him right. I may not have got him right. Some things we've got right. But the really basic question is that Paul was understanding, interpreting the gospel for his day. How do we do it today?
Thanks. I think that's a very good summing up note on which to end. For those of you who haven't got a programme or haven't worked it out, Mona's next talk is 3:15 tomorrow in Tutu, which is 3:15. The programme says 3:15. Yeah? 3:15 tomorrow. That's fine. You and she will be there at the same time in Tutu, which is way over on the other side. It is 3:15, isn't it? Yes. So thank you, Mona.